This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. It had been 15 years since the Brown versus Board of Education decision that struck down segregation in schools, but in 1969, most public schools in North Carolina were still segregated. So when Dudley Flood was called to desegregate every school in the state, he was overwhelmed, but not skeptical. He had learned from his tiny hometown in northeastern North Carolina that education could be a great equalizer. He and a fellow educator spent the next 4 years crisscrossing the state, meeting with everyone from students, parents, teachers, administrators, Black Panthers, and the KKK, and the result was a new foundation for public education in North Carolina. Dudley Flood now is an education consultant. He lives in Raleigh, and he joins me now on the State of Things. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I think your story starts in your hometown of Winton, North Carolina, which has its own interesting and rich history, right?
It does indeed. The fact is, it's not well known, but Winton was one of the earliest settlements of free black people. Not exclusively that, because there was an American Indian population there, and obviously there were whites as well. But in that community, there was little attention paid to separation per se until you reached school age. Up until that, you were just kids playing together and socializing and that sort of thing. In my particular case, we lived on what was known as the River Hill. The Joanne River runs, separates Hartford County from Bertie County. And if you lived on the River Hill, your gang was whoever lived on the River Hill or near that. And that was brought about primarily by what your parents did for a livelihood. If they worked in the industries that were associated with that and indigenous to that particular area. So many of the persons with whom I played and fraternized were different races, mostly African-American, but some white, and a few American Indians, who had not at that time been declared to be so, because until Roots came along, that identity hadn't emerged and surfaced. We knew about it, but we didn't talk about it, because you were only one of two things then. You were either white or colored. And so my orientation was not so much racially bent as it was puzzlement about why is it that we play together until a certain point, and then they go to one school and I go to another.
And that school that you went to, that segregated school that you went to, was also an institution in your community.
It was indeed. As a matter of fact, it was an institution that reached the greater area of the county and beyond, because it had been founded in the 1800s as a boarding school. And from that, it was transferred into what was known as a normal school, that being a school at which, when you graduated there, you could become a teacher. My mother attended that school, and she would have been licensed to teach had she not had nine kids, the eighth of which was a hyperkinetic kid, you now call that ADHD, named Dudley. So she had a full-time thing on her hands, so she never worked outside the home. She taught really hard in the home, and whether it was a deficit or not, we all went to school already knowing how to conjugate the verb to be in six tenses. That might have been a blessing. It could have been a deficit in some ways. But
that school, not only for Winton, but regionally, it became a magnet, right?
Yes, indeed it did, because particularly when it was a boarding school, it was the only school short of Enfield, North Carolina, where there was an institution known as Bricks Institution, to which African-American and Indian students could go for higher education, they called it. And the thing, you had a lot of, not a lot, but a few schools that went to the elementary grades, but not for the high schools. So it had a historic insistence about education, that education was the salvation, which I still believe, by the way. And there was even an air of it's your responsibility and obligation to go to school and to learn. There were a few temptations outside that, save the river on which we played, but even if there had been, the propensity to go to school was so embedded in us and inculcated that we would have done it anyway.
Well, and as you say, as a normal school, a lot of teachers came out of that, and that was a revered profession. That was something that you could look up to in your community.
I always knew I would be a teacher. I didn't know where, how, or when, but I always knew I would be a teacher because of my eight siblings, six of those, including me, became teachers. And I just thought that was the most noble contribution you could make to humankind, was to be a teacher.
You were devoted to education, except for that one day on the Chowan River when the herring were running.
Well, the Chowan River is always a temptation. And during my youth, the herrings were prolific in Chowan River, and you actually could legally go and dip herrings with a bow net, we called it. It had to be 18 inches of fur across, and I had not had that experience. I had watched it, and I'd always thought it was something you ought to do in your lifetime, so it was on my bucket list. And I had every good intention to go and dip a few herrings and dispose of them through, giving them away and getting them back to school. But Ms. Weaver, who lived across the street from me, she discerned that maybe that day I wasn't headed for school, along with Ben Watford, who was also the person who got me in trouble most of the time. And she apprehended us and said to me, where are you going? I said, to school. She said, well, you're going to learn today with that bow net. I said, we're going to learn fishing today. And she said, maybe I need to talk to your dad about this. And I said, Miss Weaver, you don't need to talk to my dad. Why don't I stop by and cut your grass this afternoon, wash your car or something? But you really don't need to talk to my dad. Because my dad had said in a number of times when he'd have his annual meeting with his nine children, all of which were never home at once, but I seemed to have always been the subject of his attention because I was hyperkinetic. And he would look at me and smile behind his frown, and he would say, now, Dudley, if the principal calls this house, I'm going to kill you. And that sank in. I really, really had no reason to be apprehensive except be sure the principal doesn't call it. And it worked. It actually worked. Now, I know that sounds truculent to modern-day parents, but that was – I did not live in the Democratic home.
No. But I think it reflects – and again, I guess judged against contemporary standards, we understand that, you know, we're not encouraging this sort of thing. But what you're reflecting is a culture of around education that was important to everybody.
Yes, it was
important
to
your neighbor who knew what you were up to and your father as well. Today I am talking with Dudley Flood on the state of things. An educator who helped desegregate North Carolina schools when many thought that would be an impossible task. You did manage to get through all of that. Where did you go after you left Winton for education?
Well, upon having graduated from there, I went to North Carolina Central University, where I worked for a bachelor's degree. And upon having finished that, I taught a few years while going to East Carolina to earn a master's degree in educational administration, in part. That was due to the fact that I had been encouraged that maybe I ought to be a principal. Never had a great desire to do so, but I was convinced that you might be able to help more students in that role. And from there, I was able to go to Duke University, where they were good enough to grant me a doctorate. And even then, I felt inadequate, so I kept going to school. Went a while to UNC Chapel Hill and a while to Elizabeth City to get an elementary certificate and a while to Hampton Institute, it was then, now Hampton University. And even then, I never really felt that I had enough education, still don't. So I've been to some schools, some part of every year since I was 5 years old, and intend to go somewhere this year. I don't ever intend to roll in a program again. I don't want any more programs.
Right.
I'm selective in finding something that I think I need to be more proficient at and try to get it. I don't think you can advocate education unless you model it. I think you have to demonstrate that you believe it to be important. And I knew my students checked. You know, they would ask you things like, when's the last time you've been in? And even as a consultant, whenever I work with a group, they say, when's the last time you've been in a class with kids? And I'm always able to say, last Saturday.
Well done.
Because this past Saturday I taught some children.
Yeah. All this while, again, growing up, you went to a segregated school. That was the law of the land. And I think perhaps, and maybe I'll ask you if you had any reason to believe that was going to change in your lifetime. But before you even answer that, was it clear to you that your school was different than, or the education you were getting was different than the white kids were getting?
It was noticeable in some superficial ways, not very tangibly. So I was aware that we got secondhand books, and I was aware of and the reason I was aware of that, because the people whose names were in the books when I got them, I knew those people who played in the river with them. But insofar as the quality of the education, it never occurred to me, because I always had the notion, still do, that I had the very finest education available. And the reason for that was we had the creme de la creme. We had all of the best African-American teachers. They couldn't teach anywhere else except us. And so there was a waiting list of competent, capable African-American teachers. And the other was that they didn't just teach the subject matter. They taught the child, which I think we don't always do anymore. They taught the whole child. You've heard that said, and sometimes we think it's lip service, but it isn't. There's more to education than there is to training. I wasn't trained. I was educated from top to bottom. Everything about your life, they intervened in it. The other advantage I felt I had was that I saw my teachers in more than one element. When I went to the grocery store, I saw my teachers. They shopped the same place I did. Went to the barbershop, there were my teachers. I went to Sunday school, there were my teachers teaching Sunday school. And so there was no avoiding teachers. So when I became a teacher, I made that my practice to show up in these same settings where you knew that I'm your teacher all the time. I mean, mm-hmm. you don't get a pass from me. And furthermore, if you don't come to my class, I'm going to find you. You know, I may not find you today, but I'll find you, first of all. And you're going to have to explain to me it had better be something really drastic that caused you not to come, because it's dishonoring me when you don't come to my class. I take it really personal. And that was the ethos within the black school. I know that to be true of all those that I was associated with, and I suspect it to have been widespread.
That said, segregation did have to fall if we were to live in an egalitarian society, and how that was done through Dudley Flood. We'll talk more about his efforts to desegregate North Carolina's public schools when The State of Things continues from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, today talking with Dudley Flood, instrumental in helping to desegregate North Carolina schools in the late 1960s and early 1970s. The Brown versus Board of Education decision came down in 1954. You were finishing up your undergraduate degree, right, at the time?
Yes, exactly at that time.
So what did you think about that decision and sort of whether or not it had anything to do with you, I guess?
Well, I was astonished because if you recall, the Brown decision in 54 simply said that we declared that the dual school system is inherently unequal. And I said, whoop-a-doo, it took you this long to figure that out. What I was more impressed with was Brown 2, which was adjudicated in 55, based on a move for further relief from Thurgood Marshall, saying, that's pretty good, but can you tell us more, in effect, in which they declared that we must move with deliberate speed. That language was interesting, but functional, to dismantle the dual school system and to remove the vestiges thereof. Now, that generated a mandate that drove North Carolina to have its permissive will to allow there to be those persons who were aggressive enough to move to a school in which their race might not be in the majority. We call that freedom of choice. I was a teacher at that time, and by that time I experienced freedom of choice readily because I was aware that some of the students who I was teaching would fare better elsewhere, not because they might get any better teaching experience, but they might get a more uniform experience about how the world works. I was an athletic coach, and I thought some of my ball players would have a better chance to get recognized and get a scholarship, because we didn't get in the newspapers very much. Although we won a lot of ball games, we didn't always get in the newspapers for having done so. So you were not allowed by law to invite your student to leave. You couldn't do that. It had to be the choice of his or her parent, which meant that maybe the more sophisticated parent who had enough knowledge to know how the system works might have been the one whose child went. That notwithstanding, I still was in great support of that. On a personal note, my wife was the first African-American teacher in that county to go into what had been a previously all-white school, and so that gave us a greater sense of identity with that school, although I already knew the coaches, as you would. You know, all coaches know all coaches. Take a lot of those you don't have to play against. You know them really well. Fish with them and hunt with them and that sort of foolishness. But then when we began the thing called freedom of choice, the interesting spectacle there was that North Carolina had a fairly consolidated control system at the state level of schools prior to that. The General Assembly, in its wisdom, decided to remand the authority for schools back to the local school boards. Now, I don't think you have to be particularly astute to understand why that was. We had at that time 152 school districts in North Carolina, which meant that if you were going to have a targeted piece of legislation or a targeted piece of policy, it would have to be individualized for the various school units as opposed to a class action suit against the state. But under that, the freedom of choice thing flourished, and flourished one way. However, I'm not aware of any white student that opted to go to a previously all-black school under that covenant, although we ran a freedom of choice thing right on through, for the most part, through 64, when you had the Civil Rights Act of 64 having a different dimension of support for the process. That dimension being that for the first time there was some incentive in the way of money applied. There was some funding that said, if you will do this, you will get this amount of help from the federal government. But there was also more of an effort to proactively require that you do a little something because you then were under surveillance from the Office of Civil Rights, which was then located inside the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had this impetus, which caused about a third of the school districts in North Carolina to develop some kind of desegregation plan. Generally, they would be the ones that would have least difficulty in doing so. For example, if you were in a school district that had only one or two or three schools, you didn't have a great problem in either closing one of those, sending everybody to the other, or in most cases, making one of those 1 through 8 and the other one senior high. And
right.
you had, quote, desegregated. Notice I'm not using the word integration
mm-hmm.
here. I'm talking desegregation, which is a legal process. Integration is a social process at which we're still working. But desegregation clearly had to come first.
Well, and you mentioned that eventually in 1964 there's a carrot, there's some money,
yeah.
and a third of the schools change, although albeit the ones that found it most easy to do it. Ultimately, the courts had to deliver a stick and say this choice program just isn't cutting it.
Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, about a third of those, of the whole, were under some suit from the federal government, and about another third were under private litigation, much of which had been fostered by Julius Chambers, who you might know about,
mm-hmm.
In his role first as an individual practitioner and then in his role as with the Legal Defense Fund of the NAACP. A great number of suits were filed through that medium. But all of those were reasonable in that eventually, they were given great latitude and great time in which to resolve these issues. Most of those issues haven't been resolved between 1969 and 1971, actually, which means that you had a pretty good runway to take off to get really serious about this thing called desegregation.
But the courts eventually said, no, the state has to be responsible for this. Even
that happened in 1969.
Yeah.
In 1969, in a decision known as Godwin versus Johnston County, the mandate was that the state has an affirmative action to dismantle the school district, the dual school districts, and to remove the vestiges thereof. It was really recalling your attention to the fact the Supreme Court had already said this, but had not been very aggressive in following through with that, at which time the state began to be serious about its responsibility because it took back its authority to manage the school systems in certain ways, and then created the Division of Technical Assistance in which I was privileged to work. And that was established in 1969 by the joint effort of Craig Phillips, who was then state superintendent, and Bob Scott, who was governor. They coalesced around that issue and made it possible for that team to be created. And so at that time, we got the mandate to do something.
Well, let's talk about that conversation when you get called in and say, Dudley, we got a problem here, and we think you can solve it. How'd that go?
Well, I was principal down in Pitt County at that time and thought I'd be there for life or longer because I had just learned how to be a good principal. It takes about 3 years to learn how to be a good principal. That's not to dismay anybody who is younger than that, but first year I was a principal, I should have paid the state. No reason they should have given me money for being principal. And you learn that by doing that. But in my school, there had been a noticeable amount of success in the desegregation of the school. And people were content so much so that there were people gravitating to the school by their own predilection. And I think Craig noted that. And then there were some other factors that caused him to say, we need you to be a part of this team. Team was already formed, and I was added as the third part of what was then a three-man team. Bob Strother having been one of those persons who had been superintendent at Greene County. Mm-hmm. Gene Cosbin and I, the third. And then, of course, Bob's job was administrative, so he didn't really have to get out into the hinterlands and that sort of thing.
So it was you and Gene Cosby being his wife, wasn't it?
Yeah, Gene's yeah. White. Gene was white. The late Gene Cosby passed away this 2-3 months ago. But we had, excuse me, mm-hmm. we had kept contact with each other every single day since then, mm-hmm. Although we hadn't officially had that responsibility since we had left the department. But we still had the predilection to do that. But when we were assigned that, we were given no direction. There was no format. We couldn't research it and see this is how that works. But we also realized that you can do it wrong when that's the case, because if you're the creator of it, then you're the adjudicator of it as well. So what we learned was to carry our respect for humanity with us at all times and to recognize that different does not mean deficient, that the fact that you're not just like me doesn't mean there's something wrong with you necessarily. Mm-hmm. It means that if we're going to do something in sync with each other, we got to reconcile some things. And from that point on, we recognize that if you can first discern the problem, understand what it is you're dealing with and the elements thereof, and you cannot go in this with the predisposition that he is right and she is wrong and that sort of thing, and you can help them to understand we're trying to get a solution here. You could almost always find goodwill emerging from that kind of configuration. More than that, we also did find every opportunity we could to see what was happening elsewhere, and almost without exception, it would be a learning situation to see this is a way not to do this. You know, this, this is a strategy that hasn't worked particularly well, and so it equipped us in that way.
Did you have any formula? Do you go in school district by school district and what, call a meeting? Do you get? I mean, where do you start with a project like this?
Almost invariably, because we could only go by invitation, they would have determined already what the format would be. If we were able to ourselves make that distinction, it would be that we would like to have the most diverse gathering that you could amass, and we would like for you to give us the full understanding of the problem as you perceived it, and we would like you to brainstorm with us as to how we might go about this so that when we get in this mass gathering, we're in one accord. But we stumbled up on something that was very helpful. One day we were headed to Hyde County. Hyde County may be the most noted aspect of our DSEG process because it had a 1970/71 school year, a year-long boycott, which became nationwide known, national news and that sort of thing. And we were just headed there for a meeting that we had been told ahead of time, everybody will be here, not just the people who live here, but whenever that kind of thing happens, you tend to draw a crowd from elsewhere, and many of whom we knew, and we knew the people who were prone to lead, that sort of thing. And we stopped at a little place to get a soda, and I saw this little paddle that has a rubber ball on a rubber band at the end of the paddle, and I noticed it was multicolored. One side of it was green, I think, and the other was red. And I bought that little 25-cent paddle for $1 and took the rubber ball off. And when we got to the gathering, I held that ball up and I said, before we begin, will you tell me what color this ball is? They said, red. I said, no, it's green. It's red, green. And we argued a while. And I turned the ball around and said, now tell me what you see here. Oh, they said, on your side is green. I said, well, here's what we want to do. We want you to understand, until you shall have seen how it looks to me on my side, you can't convince me that you know what you're talking about, because this ball is going to be red on this side and green on that side to the day it dies. Now, if I'm willing to come around here and see how it looks to you, and you're willing to come around here and look how it sees how it looks to me, then we can reconcile that. And that little episode helped us in many, many instances, that very little ball, to get people to see that there are two sides to practically everything.
Well, let me stop just there, because Hyde County was perhaps your hardest case. You talked about that year-long boycott. We should point out that there was resistance in African-American communities to this as well, right?
That's really where the resistance began.
Yeah.
Excuse me. The fact was that there was an African-American school, and like in most communities, it was the center of the community. It turns out that this particular school was going to be changed in a dramatic way, and the community didn't want it to be changed in a dramatic way. They were going to be bused up to Madam Mesquite. They were down in Swan Quarter, and they wanted to maintain a high school presence there. Well, over time, we were able to help them to understand that it may not be in your best interest just to hang on to that one thing. We'll maintain a presence, not necessarily a high school presence. And here are some dimensions of that you can retain, and so on and so forth. But the interesting thing about a situation like that is that it reaches a point of polarization at some point, and then your choice is not so much to understand the issue, it's whose side are you going to be on? Mm. You going to be with us, or you going to be against us? And even going in to intervene or help intervene in a situation like that, you're invited to be a part of the problem, really. The first thing, Gene being white, was perceived as he ought to take the white community's part. I, being black, was perceived as you ought to take the black community's part, and your failing to do so would get you called some names that were not particularly flattering. If you don't have a thick enough skin to weather that, if you're going to try to retaliate to that, you're going to be a part of the problem. But if you understand, that's a very logical reaction. People say, you know, you ought to understand this. You live with us. You're one of us. Why don't you understand this? The problem is I really do understand it more than you do, and I have to be very subtle about that, but I have to operate on what I know, not what you would like me to think, and have to recommend something here which is in the best interest of children. That's who we're here for. We're not here for you. Nobody has a right to be at school except children. Everybody else is there by privilege. And you can't say that all the time, but you have to know that and you have to believe that.
I'm talking today with Dudley Flood, an educator in North Carolina. The conversation is going on here on The State of Things. You are in a difficult position because you know that every word that issues from your mouth, if one sentence sounds like you are on the other side, that's it forever. You're never going to get that back, right?
You don't get it back. And you don't get a second chance at it either.
But you did. And it was successful. We should point out that boycott led to, I think, 7 people graduating high school that year because they were out of school so much. So it was a profound situation, polarized. You even brought the Black Panthers and KKK together in Hyde County, right?
Well, we did indeed. Actually, it was more that Golden Franks brought the contingent. He was part of the SCLC, and of course, he drew people who were on his point of view, and the local Rights of White People organization was called, brought in their persons who were sympathetic with them. That included the Ku Klux Klan, and that included some other groups. And obviously, they didn't necessarily identify themselves to us as to who is whom, but you don't have to be in a meeting very long until that emerges. But we didn't feel it was our role to judge them. We never felt that, still don't. We thought it was our role to bring some solution and present it to you, and you can accept it or reject it. But this is the solution we think best will work for you. And that was what we were able to do, and we were not the only factor to be concerned. The superintendent had to make some disposition of how he would recommend to the board. The board had to make some disposition. But I would like to think that we incited them to see a path that might have been different than polarization that existed. So if you ever thought about it, in hindsight, you might say, well, we might have been in danger here. But at that time, you're too busy trying to resolve the issue. You really, it's much like soldiers going on the battlefield. I'm sure they can't go out there saying we're going to get shot. They believe we're going to win this thing. And we always felt that way. And I can only remember two times that I felt in physical danger in the present. Sometimes after the fact, you know, that could have gone the other way pretty easily. But we weren't intimidated at all.
How did things turn out in Hyde County?
As it turned out, Hyde County went ahead and did what it had been recommended to do, and that was that Madam Mesquite became the central high school, the black school in Englehart began to send its high school component, and it became a middle school. School in Matamuskeet became, not only did it become a middle school, one through actually elementary school at that time, we called it, but it also became a cultural center. Some of the buildings that were no longer used for that purpose until, as far as I'm aware, until today, even though it no longer exists in that form, it is a cultural center for the community. What you did is to help people to think about the alternatives and the possibilities and to try best you can to remove most of the emotionalism and begin to reason through what is the long-range best thing for our children here.
Today on The State of Things, I'm talking with Dudley Flood, a lifelong educator who helped desegregate North Carolina schools in the 1960s and 70s. We'll talk more about his work in the state, some other stories about how that was done, and a look at what's going on today in North Carolina when our program continues. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachel. This hour, talking with Dudley Flood, pioneer of desegregating North Carolina's schools, a challenge you came up with ingenious ways of demonstrating the problem and ways in which people can come together. And country music played an important part in all of this. Tell us about that.
Gene was a native of Burke County. I didn't know that for a long time. When Gene and I met, he, of course, was living here in Raleigh, as was I. I've only had one prejudice that I'm aware of in my whole life, and that is I grew up in eastern North Carolina, and to my heart I thought that was the finest place on earth to be. I had a little suspicion about people who lived in the Piedmont, but the mountains, not so much. I was certain for a fact, you see one hillbilly, you've seen them all. because I had been inculcated that way. Mm-hmm. I had read the Barney Google and Snuffy Smith, and I had read Little Abner, and, you know, I knew about Dog Patch. We were up in the mountains one day doing what we were there to do, and it began to be nightfall. And I said, Gene, we need to get out of here. We need to head on down the mountains. And he said, oh, why don't we just stay and spend the night? I said, we don't have anywhere to spend the night. You know, when you're not going to do something, one excuse is good another. And I said, well, this is a vacation time for people, and they're up here, and all the hotels are full. He said, we don't need to stay at a hotel. We can stay with my parents. And I said, your parents? I said to myself, self, here's a hillbilly sitting right on your front seat. I had no notion. I thought he was an Easter. And he said to me, you didn't know this is where I'm from. Well, this is called the point of deliberation. You ask yourself at that point, what are you going to live by? You're going to live by all the stuff you heard, or you're going to begin to act on what you absolutely know about a person you've known and loved for 2 or 3 years. Well, he took me to his house, and I learned that he had a guitar, and I learned that he knew how to play that guitar. I don't think he'd had any formal lessons, but he could play that guitar and sing country music. And I prized myself in being fairly adaptable. I had done a little singing, but certainly not country music. But what I learned in listening to the country music is that all of it had a story. And most of it had a story which could be used in what we did. It could differentiate for people in ways that maybe talking to them couldn't. So Jen and I formed the habit of starting most sessions where we had the liberty to do so with a few country tunes, depending on what theme we were trying to use for that particular gathering. For example, one of my favorites was a thing that Chris Christopherson did called Jesus Was a Capricorn. And somewhere in there, the lyrics, everybody's got to have somebody to look down on. And that was so much what we were encountering, is that it seemed to me that everybody had to have somebody to look down on. So we built a series of things that we blowing in the wind was one of the things we used a whole lot. To get people in the mood to hear a message which they might not necessarily have wanted to hear. But almost without exception, it mellowed the crowd. We didn't pass ourselves as musicians. Neither of us was a musician. My wife was a musician. And Gene was a guitar picker, as simple as that. But we were fairly decent at harmonizing the country music. And I think they're not what the thing that was out of the ordinary for them was the only black guy who did country music was Charlie Pride, mm-hmm. and most of them never heard of him. And they would say, wow, this black guy's doing country music. But then just to mess them up, we'd do one pop song along with the way, something that came from my heroes, Billy Eckstine and Nat King Cole or some of those. And we'd make reference to the fact, you know, you don't have to be just like me to like what I like and for me to like what you like. So it was very helpful to us. The detriment to it was sometimes they get too carried away with the music and think that was what we did, you know.
Yeah. But they kept calling for encores and you couldn't get out of the business at hand.
Well,
but what did it do for you? You know, I mean, there's sort of the genius of turning that into, again, another teaching moment, another teaching tool. But how about what it did for you, the recognition of your own prejudice and how it was at work at such a deep level that you hadn't even recognized it, and now it brought this to the surface. I'm wondering if it changed your approach from that day forward in the groups that you talked to.
It caused me to know that nobody's exempt from prejudice. No matter how much you believe that you've grown, there's an element of residual prejudice still in you. It is how you deal with it that matters. It's not that you don't have it. You've lost some credibility with me when you say to me, I love everybody. You don't even know everybody. So how do you love everybody? You're not Jesus. You're not the prophets. You don't love everybody. Right. What you can convince me is I don't hate anybody. You can convince me of that. And after that, the graduation toward love is a really good thing. But you may never reach that. What I want people to know is that I don't believe that ipso facto you are different from me makes that a deficit on your part. And all of our work was aimed toward building equal status relations. Ultimately, when you got to the second phase after the legal phase of desegregation and headed toward integration, that removal of the vestiges was the critical part, which I still do every day I get a chance. And that is to help people understand how equal status relationships are critical for a democratic society, so that your voice is one voice, mine is one voice. It doesn't matter how many experiences and exposures I've had. It doesn't play against the fact that you have a voice and you're entitled to that voice. And I ought to listen to it as much as I talk to you. I shouldn't just do all the talking because I'm a day older, maybe had one more educational experience than you. There should be a reciprocity here that we understand what you think is important. And if there's some reason for you to hear what I'm saying, that reason is going to be enhanced by my listening to you first and more thoroughly, and not just looking at you and acting as though I'm listening, waiting for my turn to speak, but actually internalizing what you're saying to me so I get the feeling of it, the depth of it. That's why I don't like telephone conversations. I'd rather sit across the table from you. The whole body language is lost in the telephone conversation. I want to know what you're doing. I don't just want to know what you're saying. I mean, I could say, oh, you're a burnt match on the telephone. But if you don't see the passion, people are way more convinced by how steadfast you are in your belief than they are by your intellect.
That's the interpersonal dynamic, and clearly you've made a compelling case for it, that this is the level at which we have to have this conversation, to listen deeply, to listen radically to one another, to find out what we have in common. And, you know, what about each other we might not like and we might continue to dislike. But then you pointed earlier to these things called vestiges, these kind of institutional subterranean factors that we aren't aware of. I am not a racist, but I am the keeper of a racist institution. It is a vestige. How do we become aware of that and acknowledge it without becoming defensive?
If we're able to understand, and those of us who call ourselves teaching that are able to understand that everybody has a stake in a free and open society, and that equality, which we've thrown around, is not a reachable goal. Equity is a reachable goal. You don't hear me say people are equal. I don't believe people are equal. I want equity, not equality. I'm only going to be 6 feet tall, no matter how you look at it. So I'm not the equal of Michael Jordan when I played basketball. I couldn't jump as high as he. I'm just as good a person as he. And a good example that I often would use in my city, which I love, Raleigh, I get equal treatment in the dispensation of resources. The garbage person who picks up garbage comes to my house once a week, just like he goes to everybody else's house once a week. Problem is, at my house, I don't really need a garbage man. I'm a conservative consumer. If I'm going to eat one pork chop, I buy one pork chop. I got three cats out in my backyard. They eat the debris. I raise earthworms. They eat the vegetation, so I don't need a garbage man. But less than three blocks from me are people where there are 20 people using one garbage can. You know, what I need you to do is pick up theirs twice a week. Skip me for a couple of weeks. That's equity. You put resources where they are needed. Now, that's not just my benevolence. It's protective for me as well. The rat can walk three blocks. Mm-hmm. And if they are having difficulty there, eventually I'm going to have the same difficulty, even if I just want to be selfish about it. But I would hope that I think it's right to give where the need is, as opposed to just being sure. Well, we treated all of you alike.
Right.
I don't treat everybody alike, not even in my own family. I have some people who are more needed than others. You treat them according to their need as best you can discern it. And so if that were the case, talk about school. The way in which we dispense resources for schools, we have a per-pupil allotment. Who thinks that you can buy the same thing in Terrell County for a dollar that you can buy in Wake County or in Chapel Hill? Who thinks that? I mean, who is far enough out to think that when you can't even go to a movie in your own town, you got to ride all the way to Williamston from Columbia to go to a movie, that a dollar goes the same distance? Well, that's just a surface thing. Who thinks that a teacher who is there is going to gravitate to Terrell County or to Dare County for the same salary that you're going to gravitate to Chapel Hill for? There are good reasons to be in Chapel Hill other than the work that you're there to do. So if we really were serious about educating those kids at the same level, we would get the very best persons we could get, entice them to go by the only way we know, and that is giving them more money than we give somebody else. But it's done in exactly the opposite. That is that they have no supplement. There's nothing to tax there unless you want to tax seaweed. So they will never be able to give a local supplement. Everybody knows that. I mean, it isn't as though we don't know it. So you're perpetuating. We can call it racism if you want. It just happenstance that 65% of those people are black who live there. And you could go right on through the black belt from I-95 east north of Greenville. And you would find pretty much the same thing till you got to Dare County. We know that. So the fact that we've done nothing about it means we just don't have the permissive will to modify that. We can educate whomever we believe education to be in our best interest to educate, whenever we choose. We've already demonstrated we know how to do that. But the will isn't there. And so racism to me is institutional. I don't see it as an individual proposition. I think it's institutional that we somehow want to maintain a private underclass, a permanent underclass. And one way to do that is disenfranchise a fair number of people from education. It's not limited to blacks. There are poor whites in northeastern North Carolina who are getting no education or little education, and we already know that, and nothing is being done to interrupt that. So one of the things that desegregation was intended to do was to level the playing field, to provide opportunities for those people to do so. And there are so many ramifications of it that everywhere you went, you found a different manifestation. You know, you couldn't generalize and say that if you solve this problem, it's statewide. It wasn't. Almost invariably. I'll give you just one example. Almost without exception, when we were able to rectify a situation, get people to talk with each other, there was substantial, quote, middle class, as bad as I hate that term. That was what you had to find, was a middle class. When you found a place where there was no noticeable middle class, for example, if let's just use a physician example. At UNC Hospital, the doctors are white, the orderlies are black. You're not going to reconcile that. That isn't going to be reconciled. But if you had a middle class there, let's say the nurses, the PAs and this sort of thing, who were various demographics, you have a whole lot better chance of bringing some cohesion among those people there. So what we always had to do is to look for that situation. If you were in a recreational place where all the people who own the beach are white and all the people who scrub the bathrooms are black, you're not going to reconcile that. You've got to find some middle ground. You've got to find somewhere in there where there are people who realize that we are served by these people who are scrubbing those floors, and the same way we'll serve by the owner, maybe better.
Well, I'm wondering, and just to be clear, I took your example of UNC hospitals not to be you saying that the doctors are white and
They were then.
I see.
Yes, they were white, very white.
So what – but now we're hearing, and I think there's pretty good evidence to show that schools are resegregating. Mm-hmm. Was your work in vain?
No. We did the launching pad. Now – we never thought we had completed the cycle, because when people ask me, were you the first black to do this or that or the other, I reject that as an honor. I want to know who was the second black, the third black, and the fourth black. What I did was in vain only if it didn't open a door for somebody else. When I was associate state superintendent, three black people have been associate state superintendent since I was, albeit I was the first. Following me was Sammy Campbell Parrish, and following her was Henry Johnson, and so on. The telling about the growth of what we're trying to do is, what did you generate and stimulate, not how you fared individually. And I think some of that is being lost now. I don't think people are trying to recreate the impetus which they might have worked to create.
How do we get it back? We only have about a minute left, but if we're resegregating now, what do we do?
There has to be a revisitation of the value of having diversity in society. It's not a popular topic. You're the first person who's asked me this, by the way, in a very long time. Most people are content with the fact that I'm doing pretty well, and so I shouldn't bother this. And until we begin to realize that none of us is a whole lot better off than all of us, it's going to be very difficult to get back to that.
I have to ask you, you know, we had evidence of that in Wake County. We had a system that for 10 years had become a model school system nationwide, and research had shown it was precisely the diversity that was improving everyone's education, and they came in and dismantled the whole thing anyway.
Yes. Well, that's the pendulum swing proposition. It'll come back. It'll be a while, but it'll come back, because I think that if something is proven to be good and effective, over time, reasonable people will prevail, and they'll say, we need to revisit that again.
Dudley Flood, great pleasure. Thank you so much for being on the program.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Dudley Flood is a lifelong educator, a champion of desegregation in North Carolina. You can find out more about his career at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Our engineer and technical director is Robin Copley. Our intern is Jess Clark. WUNC's news director is Brent Wolf. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.